On the program today, you. Yes, you. Also, regulating AI as best the White House can, and the subway submerged. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, today, the 30th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So, how are you feeling? Not overall. I mean, the news is grim. Life is busy. I get that. I'm asking how you're feeling economically. Mixed is the answer, apparently, according to a new poll from the good people at Harris. They asked self-identified middle-class Americans about their views on this economy. The majority, 44%, said they are stressed about the economy. That's up 4% from a year ago. 34%, though, said they are optimistic about it, and that's up 8%. So, why, oh, why is the economic picture still so blurry? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab gets us going.
The most stressful part of Alex Loeber's house is the kitchen.
If we had a food pantry, I think that would save our collective mental health by 50%.
Loeber, his wife, and kid live in a two-bedroom house in Atlanta. They'd love to move into a bigger space, but with interest rates so high, it's just not feasible right now. So they're storing their food under the TV.
That stuff usually gets pulled out by our two-year-old, and sometimes you just have a few dented cans of tomatoes.
A few dented cans isn't the end of the world, but it's one of those frustrating daily reminders of the trade-offs Loeber's family has been making when it comes to housing, groceries, and daycares. Because after years of squirreling a few dollars away,
it just doesn't feel like we're building up those savings anymore.
The personal savings rate has dropped significantly from its historic pandemic high. It means the spending spree Americans have been on, well, it's a lot less fun. Or even doable, especially now, says Isabel Sawhill, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, since costs are significantly and permanently higher.
And they thought this was all temporary. And so pretty soon prices are going to come down again. And the fact that they haven't come down is, I think, a surprise to them.
Change is hard, even if your raise does cover how much extra you're spending at the grocery store.
Some of it is just an adjustment process. You've got to make adjustments in your life, and adjustments are always anxiety-producing.
She says some of the anxiety will go away with time, and maybe it's finally started to. Justin Wolfers, an economist at the University of Michigan, says the 34% of people who feel optimistic gets at that.
More people are finding work. More people are starting businesses.
Plus, he says it's one thing for people to feel a certain way about the economy, but what matters is how they participate in it.
The reality is, if you wanted to measure how optimistic people are, possibly the best one is to look at their spending patterns.
He says if people thought there were dark, stormy clouds around the corner, they'd stop spending. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Remember, that recession that was 6 months away has been coming for a year and a half now. Two quick things as we head off into the rest of the program. Jay Powell and the gang at the Fed meet tomorrow and Wednesday. The economic outlook and interest rates will be on the agenda. No change in rates this time is where the smart money is. Do not trade on that, by the way. Consult your own financial advisor. Also, there is word today there's a tentative deal between GM and the United Auto Workers. If and when all three tentative deals are ratified, Ford and Stellantis already announced, as you've surely heard, that would bring an end to the 6 or so week UAW strike. Wall Street on this Monday, all sunshine and light. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Among the data points sure to be considered and discussed at that Fed meeting tomorrow and Wednesday is the latest employment cost index, which we will get tomorrow. The ECI, as it's known, is put out by the Bureau of Labor Statistics every quarter and gives a measure of the cost, just like it sounds, of labor. Last we heard, which is to say last quarter, labor was costing companies less. So just because it is good to be aware of these things, a couple of minutes now about the ECI.
I think you should call me John. My last name is pronounced Rooser. Think of it as the farm animal without a T.
Noted, John. John Rooser is the president of the consulting firm Insights into Comp LLC.
And before that, I had 31 years in the federal statistical system. 27 of them were with the BLS.
So he knows a thing or two about the ECI.
One is that it captures the cost not only for wages, but also covers the costs of benefits provided to workers.
Health insurance, paid time off, retirement plans.
The other feature of the ECI is that it's designed in a way that it's not affected by movements of labor across occupations and industries.
The BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics in the Labor Department, surveys a bunch of companies.
They draw out a sample that is designed to represent the full economy. And so that means a certain number of companies in a certain industry, for example.
And then they pay those companies a visit.
And then they collect a whole battery of data about wages, other monetary expenditures on labor, but also a lot of other data on the provisions of benefits. And then after several years in the sample, the company is rotated out and other companies are brought in.
All right. So now that we know that, how the thing works, what are economists actually going to be looking for in the data?
My name is Nicole Smith, and I'm the chief economist at the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce.
And?
What we'll be looking for is, are employers still continuing to bump up compensation for workers? And that tells you that, you know, they're still trying to attract new workers.
And the Fed, Jay Powell and company?
They don't want to see a DCI that's increasing too quickly, but one that is moving at least in tandem with inflation, or at least maintaining the purchasing power of individuals.
My guess, by the way, he'll get at least one question, Mr. Powell will, on the ECI at his press conference on Wednesday. This is a big labor market data week this week. By the by, we'll get the job openings and labor turnover survey for September on Wednesday. Jolts, you know it, you love it. And then Friday, the biggie, the October jobs report. The challenge as governments try to regulate technology, and this is not a new thing, is that technology moves fast. Government does not. Thus, we find ourselves today with the Biden administration doing what it can to regulate new kinds of artificial intelligence. An executive order was the form that today's announcement took, with a slew of orders for executive agencies and requests and suggestions for things the private sector might do to rein in this mostly unregulated AI space. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports from Washington on how much of the future of artificial intelligence is actually under presidential purview.
This executive order attempts to set new standards for how we develop, test, and use AI in government as well as within private industry. Meredith Broussard is the author of a new book on AI and bias in tech and teaches at NYU. She says this order is a very big deal.
What it says is that developers of the most powerful AI systems must share their safety test results and other critical information with the government.
And develop tools to ensure the AI systems are safe for consumers. Now, whether or not the Biden administration can, without a law from Congress, force companies to do this is less clear. Neil Chilson is a senior research fellow at the Center for Growth and Opportunity.
There's some things that are probably within the presidential power, but are potentially questionable. Calls for additional guidance. Lots and lots of, hey, let's use existing legal authorities to look at this.
Chilson says it will take months, if not years, for new regulations to come down the pipeline. But in the meantime, AI is already helping make decisions affecting people's lives. Alexandra Reeve Givens is president and CEO of the Center for Democracy and Technology.
If you've applied for a job lately, if you've applied for a loan, if you've applied to be approved for housing, if you've applied for public benefits, AI systems are being used in each of those moments.
Givens says one of the ways the Biden administration hopes to influence those systems is by updating the rules around the billions of dollars the federal government spends buying goods and services from the private sector.
Now, if you're a contractor trying to sell a system to the federal government, this is going to set kind of the new standards that you need to be able to prove you're compliant with.
And when you're talking that kind of money, that kind of influence can be rolled out a lot more quickly. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
So here's an infrastructure story wrapped in a climate change story inside the most economically critical city in this country. The New York City subway is 100 years old. More than 3 million people ride it every day, many of them to work. It is also more and more frequently flooding, and not just a little bit, because of extreme rainfall, which is becoming more common as the planet gets hotter. Last month, the remnants of Tropical Storm Ophelia dumped inches per hour of rain, several inches per hour in some parts of the city, which, if you happened to have seen some of the video, you know did not go well in the New York City subway. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
At one point during that storm in late September, every single subway line in the city was either fully or partially suspended or running with delays. Videos of water pouring down subway steps and through vents onto platforms and into tunnels flooded social media. People were stranded underground and above ground. It was a mess. It was also deja vu all over again.
We design our sewers to absorb a rainfall of 1.75 inches per hour.
Rohit Agarwal is New York City's chief climate officer and commissioner of the Department of Environmental Protection, which is in charge of the sewers.
And until 2021, that was a pretty conservative number.
It's not anymore. Since 2021, several storms have dumped more rain than that in an hour and overwhelmed the sewer system. When that happens, the water flows down into any other openings it can find, including the subway, which, of course, is mostly underground.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Some of what needs to be done to prevent rain from flooding the subway are huge infrastructure projects that will take years and cost billions. But there are smaller things that can make a difference in the meantime.
All right, so we're at Chambers Street Station at West Broadway on the 1, 2, and 3 trains.
Eric Wilson works on climate resilience and sustainability planning at the MTA, which runs the subway. He's brought me to this particular station in downtown Manhattan because it flooded in a rainstorm back in 2007, but not in this last storm we had, and he wants to show me why.
So let's go up to the surface and I'll show you some stormwater protection.
First up, elevated vents on the sidewalk. Unlike most of the metal grates you see all over the city that allow airflow into the subway, these vents are not flush with the sidewalk. They're raised a few inches.
What they're designed to do is to prevent stormwater that overtops this curb from penetrating down into the vents.
Looking at them, it doesn't seem like just a few inches would make much of a difference. But Wilson says it does. So does raising station entrances.
Let's go look.
Yeah, let's go take a look. So we'll see a relatively small step.
At this entrance to the Chambers Street station, instead of just walking off the sidewalk straight down the stairs, you step up from the sidewalk first.
This one is just a couple of inches. It's to prevent stormwater from, you know, just flowing directly down into the stairs.
Halfway down the block, Wilson points out one more thing. In the street, the curb is much deeper by the storm drain, or catch basin, and the road itself is angled to funnel rainwater toward the drain.
All these kinds of very nuanced things that you might not notice are actually really critical to keep stormwater from entering the subway station.
So is keeping catch basins clear of trash and leaves, he says, something the city's been pushing in a big way.
That is likely to be good enough for the places that we affected by flood accumulations of, say, 4 inches or 5 inches.
But Marcel Negret at the nonprofit Regional Plan Association says for other stations, like ones that are downslope,
where you would see deeper levels of flooding, you probably need something else.
Since the 2007 storm that flooded the Chambers Street station, the MTA has spent $64 million to mitigate flash flooding in the subway. The current capital plan includes $75 million more for stormwater mitigation and additional funding for related projects like wells and pumping infrastructure. But it's not just up to the MTA. The city also needs a lot more permeable surfaces above ground, more gardens, parks, buildings, and roads that can absorb water before it gets to the sewer or the subway. Rohit Agarwal, the city's chief climate officer, says that work is happening, but it's going to take time. There's no way around it.
I think New Yorkers have this tendency to assume that when it rains, no matter how hard it rains, everything should work normally. There shouldn't be any flooding in the street. All the trains should run.
But he says that's not the world we live in anymore. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up, love it or hate it.
A lot of it is policy, right?
First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 511 points today, 1.6%, 32,928. The NASDAQ lifted 146 points, 1.2%, 12,789. S&P 500 up 49 points, 1.2%, 41.66. If you have not yet bought your candy for the trick-or-treaters tomorrow, you might be in for some sticker shock. Candy and gum prices are an average of 13% higher than this time last year. So let us check in on some Halloween candy makers, shall we? Hershey, maker of the eponymous chocolate bar, and Mr. Good Bar of the Looking For variety. Sweetened 1%. Mondelez International, which owns the Cadbury chocolate brand, increased 1.5%. Tootsie Roll Industries, which also makes Junior Mints and Dots gumdrops, swelled 2.1% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note went the other way, 4.88%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Listening to corporate earnings conference calls, usually the CEO, the chief financial officer as well, opening up the books for the quarter in question. Those calls are never really entertaining, but they can often give you a hint of where a given business is looking for its next opportunities. Case in point, United Parcel Service, UPS, leadership of which noted in the company's earnings call last week that its returns business has grown 25% since 2020. It also announced that it's going to buy a reverse logistics company. Yes, a reverse logistics company called Happy Returns, terms not disclosed. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has that one.
The way Happy Returns works is you bring whatever item it is you want to return to one of their drop-off locations. Say, a bathing suit, because show me the person who shops online who hasn't returned a bathing suit. You show them QR code, and they'll take it.
Thing is, you don't have to worry about boxing it back up, putting a label on it. You kind of give them your bathing suit and go, here.
Kathy Robertson is the research manager for the Reverse Logistics Association. She used to work for UPS more than a decade ago. She points out the company already works in reverse logistics, and that by buying Happy Returns, UPS is getting its more than 10,000 drop-off locations, where they'll be able to pick up a bunch of packages.
Instead of having to go door to door to door to pick them up.
Which, she points out, is way more expensive. Also, Happy Returns drop-off locations are in existing retail stores, such as Staples, Best Buy, GameStop. And Bloomberg Intelligence analyst Lee Klaskow points out a UPS driver might be going there anyway.
So chances are the UPS driver might have been going to that store to drop off a package. And so if they're able to pick up stuff also, that's a benefit.
Klaskow says this acquisition also gives UPS a bigger chunk of the growing returns market. You might be thinking, isn't taking someone's returned bathing suit, no box, no label, kind of complicated? Maybe. But Klaskow says UPS can handle it. And he says retailers might even be willing to pay the company extra for boxing up the goods if it means they get the items back sooner.
They're getting the value of getting it back into their inventory, being able to resell it quicker, or do whatever they want to do.
UPS, in its earnings call last week, noted that an estimated 20 to 30% of all online orders are now returned. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
The future of American roads is electric. Maybe not soon, but eventually. There are some obstacles in the way, for sure. Convincing consumers to buy them, convincing car companies, more car companies, to make them, and finding convenient ways to charge them. those EVs. Because maybe the biggest obstacle standing in the way of our all-electric future on the roads always seems to come down to batteries. Some of their components are hard to source, they're expensive to make, and they don't have enough capacity for some drivers' needs and wants. Also, many of the batteries that are in cars right now can't be recycled at the end of their life. But there are some companies and researchers out there who think the future might be less dependent on big batteries if we can figure out a way to charge cars wirelessly. Marketplace's Henry Epp explains.
Deep in an office park in South Burlington, Vermont, Jonathan Chia with the company Resonant Link pushes a cart covered in coils and wires, a prototype really, towards a sleek black pad with what looks like a neon green bullseye in the center.
So it's ready to charge on the screen. I'm going to wheel this in.
Above the pad, a screen flashes on.
And then it's going to go, waiting for alignment, trying to charge, and then it should...
A cooling fan on the pad whirs to life, and according to that screen, electricity is flowing to the cart across nearly a foot of empty space. Though it's pretty sensitive if anything other than the cart gets too close, like my microphone.
You're a little closer.
This is a demonstration of our novel foreign object detection system. So
that's Jonathan's colleague Skylar Cornell chiming in. The team is still working out kinks, but Resonant Link hopes the wireless charging technology, which uses a magnetic field to transfer energy, could eventually revolutionize the way we power lots of different vehicles, starting in the glamorous world of fulfillment centers, says the company's CEO Grayson Zuloff.
If you imagine an Amazon or a Walmart fulfillment center or maybe a warehouse today, they have these aisles, which are called racks, and vehicles work up and down one of these aisles.
Zuloff says those electric forklifts spend a lot of downtime plugged into a wall charging, so Resonant Link wants to install its wireless chargers along the aisles.
And it'll power that forklift when it pulls up from the side.
The forklift makes a bunch of stops as it picks up and drops off items.
And as the forklift goes up and down this aisle moving goods, where it already stops, it gets power.
The idea is those frequent power boosts let the forklift work 24/7, Zuloff says. Investors have bet $20 million on Resonant Link's technology so far, and the company says it's begun shipping its charging system to some leading forklift manufacturers. And the company, along with other researchers, is betting frequent bursts of wireless charge can work for other kinds of vehicles that follow consistent routes and make lots of stops. Think buses and delivery trucks, says Andrew Mintz with the National Renewable Energy Lab.
Throughout the day, the overall charge that it picks up at each of these stops allows us to reduce the battery capacity of the vehicle so we can reduce weight and improve the efficiency of the vehicle.
The same technology could even power semi-trucks with a bunch of wireless chargers embedded in interstates. Vehicles could continuously charge up while driving, says Talis Blalack, who until recently was the managing director of a federally funded roadway electrification research center.
So it ends up being much cheaper to build infrastructure that everyone uses rather than pay money for lots of large batteries.
There are pilot projects experimenting with electrified roads in Detroit, Utah, Florida, and overseas in Sweden. But if the idea of charging your car while driving on an interstate like you're on some kind of Mario Kart racetrack sounds a bit futuristic, it still kind of is. Again, researcher Talis Blalack.
So the limitations are, a lot of it is policy. Right.
To make this a reality, transportation departments would have to install wireless chargers in roads. Then they'll have to get electricity to those roads. Ultimately, he says, it'll take several levels of government to make all that happen.
The technology can do it. Can we get the political alignment to make it happen is the real question.
A bill introduced in the U.S. House earlier this year would give $250 million in grants to wireless charging projects, though it's still waiting for a jolt of power to get out of committee. I'm Henry Ebb for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today comes to us courtesy of the German Federal Statistical Office, which announced today The GDP there shrank 0.1% July through September. Remember last week we were talking about how the United States is far and away the healthiest major economy in the world, 4.9% growth in gross domestic product. Thanks mostly to, again, where we started, you, the humble American consumer. The German slowdown, driven by a fall in consumer spending. All right, we're going. Here's your moment of economic context. Data from Zillow spotted in the Wall Street Journal. Things that were important when buying a home during the waning days of the pandemic, but are not now. Listings mentioning home offices down 41% the first half of this year versus 2022. Peloton rooms, which I guess are a thing, down 24% year on year. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Sophia Terenzio. Don't at me if you're a Peloton user and you've got a room for it. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.